Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I have fond memories of my mother's cooking after we were released, and our next home was in the Mexican-American barrio, and everybody was Mexican. We were the only Japanese family, much less Asian family, in our neighborhood of East L.A. My mother made friends with Mrs. Gonzalez, our neighbor, and they lived in each other's kitchens, and she learned how to cook Mexican. It was great. The best tacos and enchiladas were made by Mrs. Takei in East L.A.
Welcome to Your Mama's Kitchen, the podcast that explores how we're shaped as adults by the kitchens we grew up in as kids. I'm Michelle Norris. On this episode, I'm talking to actor, author, and activist George Takei, and this is going to be a very special conversation. George is probably best known for playing Lieutenant Hikaru Sulu in Star Trek, a brave man who always kept his cool when things got a little hairy while the Starship Enterprise was exploring the final frontier. In real life, George has also explored several frontiers as a beloved actor, celebrated across the globe as an activist who consistently speaks out about human rights and civil rights, as a vocal and effective advocate for LGBTQ+ rights, and as an elder statesman that uses his youthful energy to get young people involved in politics. When you get to know George, it's easy to see why his whole life has been shaped by politics. Laughter comes easy for him. He's got a playful, almost mercurial sense of humor, and you'll hear that in this conversation. But that stands in stark contrast to a very painful family history. George Takei's family members were among the more than 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry that were rounded up and shipped away against their will to relocation camps after the Japanese military's surprise attack on Pearl Harbor. Those families had to leave behind businesses, farms, homes, and most of their belongings. This can be hard listening, but I'm grateful to George for reaching back and sharing these stories with us. This is a conversation about loss, but also about strength and resilience, and how food and family were at the center of all of that. In this episode, George Takei on overcoming a painful past, finding early acceptance among the Latino community in East L.A., gaining stardom through Star Trek, and the food that has sustained him throughout his life, including a dish called Japanese footballs. Trust me, they sound delicious. George Takei, thank you so much for being with us. I was really looking forward to this conversation.
Well, we waited a long time for this, so
well,
I'm
we're
so going to
make sure that
together.
It's worth it. I'm so very glad that you are with us. This is a podcast that explores how the things that we saw and heard and experienced and felt in our kitchens. And so as you think about the kitchens of your youth, because your family moved around a lot, what are the sights and the smells and the sounds that you think about when you close your eyes and think about your mama's kitchen?
Well, I had a very unusual American childhood. I grew up behind American barbed wire fences with sentry towers and armed soldiers in them. And in the second camp we went to, in addition to the armed soldiers, we had machine guns pointed down at us. Pearl Harbor was bombed. And overnight, we were looked at with suspicion. We're Americans. My mother was born in Sacramento, California. My father was a San Franciscan. We three kids were born in Los Angeles, but we looked exactly like the people that bombed Pearl Harbor. But we lived in the United States. 125,000 of us were living on the West Coast, and this country went crazy. Racism and war hysteria is a venomous combination. They looked at us with suspicion and fear and outright hatred when we had nothing to do with Pearl Harbor. My parents were spat at, yelled at, and assaulted on the street. My father's car was painted in red with three letters, J-A-P, on it. Some of our Japanese-American friends had rocks thrown through their windows. And even the great president of the United States got swept up in it. He signed Executive Order 9066, which ordered all Japanese-Americans on the West Coast, from the Mexican border to the Canadian border, to be summarily rounded up with no charge, no trial, no due process. And I still remember, I was a five-year-old child, but I remember that morning in May when our father came into the bedroom I shared with my brother Henry. He dressed us hurriedly and told us to wait in the living room while he and our mother did some last-minute packing. We had a baby sister. She was an infant in a crib in our parents' bedroom. And so Henry and I were dressed, and we went to the living room, standing by the front window, just gazing out at the neighborhood. And suddenly we saw two soldiers, American soldiers, marching up our driveway. They carried rifles with shiny bayonets on them. They stomped up the front porch and with their fists began banging on the front door. Henry and I were petrified. My father came out of my parents' bedroom, answered the door, and one of the soldiers pointed his bayonet at our father. The other soldier said, "Get your family out of this house, our home." My father gave Henry and me boxes about this size, tied in twine. They had prepared that. Mm-hmm. And he hefted two heavy suitcases, and we followed him out onto the driveway. And we waited for our mother to come out. And when my mother came out, escorted by the other soldier, she had our baby sister in one arm and a huge duffel bag in the other, and tears were streaming down her cheeks. That morning is seared into my memory. I'm 86 years old, but I still remember that morning in May of 1942. For the next 4 years, my mother didn't have a kitchen. We all ate in a mess hall. We were first taken to the Santa Anita racetrack. We were taken in a bus caravan, about four buses. And we were unloaded, herded over to the stable area. And each family was assigned a horse stall to sleep in. On the ground, insects were skittering about. The stench of horse manure was still fresh. Flies were buzzing in the air. And I remember my mother mumbling, "So degrading, so degrading." And we lined up in mile-long lines for slop that they fed us. We were there for about 4 months, and then they announced that we're going to be traveling again, but this time by train. We'd never ridden out of train before, so we were excited, but all the grown-ups were so solemn, and some of the ladies were weeping. It was a journey of 3 days and 2 nights through the southwestern desert. And finally, on the third morning, we started seeing vegetation. And as we went further, more vegetation, and then lush vegetation, there were these huge, great trees rising up out of black water. My father told us it was the swamps. Those are swamp trees. And then the train started to slow down. And before too much longer, we saw barbed wire fences beside the train window. They built the prison camp right parallel to the railroad track. And then we started seeing hordes, masses of Japanese people just standing there looking up at us. And beyond the people, I saw rows and rows and rows of black tar paper barrack. One of those, one unit in one of those black tar paper barracks was to be our home.
Hmm.
This was a place, a camp called Camp Roer, R-O-H-W-E-R, Roer.
Mm-hmm.
There was two barracks that were mashed together, and that's where we had our meals. And I remember my mother saying, "I love cooking for my children." This is after the war. She said the most painful part was not having a kitchen to cook for my family.
Hmm.
After we were released, and I was in my early teens, I was very curious about the internment. And I asked my father about after dinner. I peppered him with questions, and he said, "Well, one of our first meals was beef brain." And I said, "What?" He said, "We didn't know what it was either. It was this brown stuff. That was what they fed us." So my childhood mother's kitchen didn't exist.
May I ask a question about when you left your home, when you were taken from your home? You and your brother each had a box. Your father had two suitcases. You described that your mother had your baby sister in one arm and a big duffel bag in the other. And most of us can't imagine. You're told you have to pack everything up and you might not be able to come back. What do you put inside that bag to try to create a life in a place that you don't even know about? You don't even know where you're going. What did your mother, and she only had one arm because she had to carry that baby was so young. What did she put in that duffel bag to help prepare you for a journey that she couldn't even comprehend?
Her duffel bag was very heavy. My mother was a stout lady, and she could heft that heavy duffel bag. And on the train trip to Arkansas, for us, for Henry and me, us kids, my baby sister was just an infant. That was a magical duffel bag because whenever we got little whiny or antsy, she would dig in there and find a Cracker Jack box or an animal cracker or a couple of lollipops. And so that was a wonderful gift-loaded duffel bag. But she had something else there that we didn't know about. My father didn't know what she had either. And she kept, my father said, tried to help her. And she said, no, I'll carry it. She had bundles of baby blankets wrapped around something heavy. And she pulled it out and unwrapped it. And lo and behold, it was her new portable sewing machine.
Mm.
That was contraband. Any mechanical thing with sharp points or sharp edges was verboten. And she knew it. And she marched past all those armed MPs with that heavy bag. And when my father saw that, he was aghast. He was shocked. He didn't know what to think. And she said, children will be needing clothes. She was thinking of the future. Little children grow fast. They grow out of the clothes. And so that's why she brought that portable sewing machine. And it was new. So my mother doesn't like to waste things.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't, even food, she brought back from the mess hall so that we could have it for a snack later on.
George Takei, I want to ask you about what life was like when you were finally allowed to leave those camps and you went back to Southern California. Was there any kind of re-entry program? Was there any kind of apology? Was there any kind of effort to help a family like yours get back on their feet?
We were all impoverished. Shortly after Pearl Harbor, they froze our bank accounts. They destroyed my father's business. We couldn't pay the mortgage on our house, so we didn't pay it. Everything was taken from us, and we were imprisoned. The gates were thrown open. The government gave us each, every one of us, 125,000 of us, a one-way ticket to anywhere in the United States, plus $25 to start life anew from nothing. $25. And the hatred was still intense. The war may be over, but the attitudes and the discrimination was intense. Jobs were near impossible. Housing was impossible. Our first home was on Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles. It was a horrific homecoming. In Skid Row, where the stench of human excrement everywhere, on the sidewalk, in the hallways of the flop house that became our home. So from that, my parents worked long, hard, killing hours, working their fingers to the bones. My father's first job was as a dishwasher in a Chinatown restaurant. Only other Asians would hire us. So it took them 4 years of scrimping and saving and getting a little savings put together. And they had the down payment on a 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom home in our old Wilshire district.
As your family moved and started to establish themselves and got their financial footing and you know, were able to enter a phase of, I guess, re-entry, how did your mother take that space, the kitchen, and try to use that as a place that provided not just nourishment, but also stability for her family?
Well, it was... I have fond memories of my mother's cooking after we were released and we moved to on Skid Row. Our flop house did not have a kitchen, but our next home was in the Mexican-American barrio. And everybody was Mexican. we were the only Japanese family, much less Asian family in our neighborhood of East LA. And my mother made friends with Mrs. Gonzalez, our neighbor, and they lived in each other's kitchens. And she learned how to cook Mexican. And we, Henry and I, thought it was great. The best tacos and enchiladas were made by Mrs. Takei in East LA. Henry and I had taco eating contests, get my mother in the kitchen. And because we were so enthusiastic about eating her tacos, we started gaining weight. And my mother, especially because there was such privation, she got things that were too rich for us to eat, and we got fat. Walking home with my friend Honorato, he would invite me over to visit his mother's kitchen. And I still remember the rich aroma of fresh corn tortilla, just freshly made. You walked into the back door, and that was where Honorato's mother's kitchen was. And the whole room was filled with that wonderful aroma. And she would take a fresh tortilla and spread some frijoles, that's bean, on it and roll it up. And we had that as an after-school snack. And sometimes I got Honorato to come. We lived a little further away. Honorato to come rather than my stopping at his mother's kitchen. And my mother fixed her special after-school treat for us. And she wanted something very American. We had white Wonder Bread. And she gave Honorato and me white bread with white sugar on it.
It's a sugar sandwich.
It was so good and so bad for us.
We're on a podcast, so people can't see you, but I wish they could, because when you're describing this kitchen, the joy is apparent. You know, as you're almost pantomiming what she's cooking. You know, I see you're doing the motions and the wide smile on your face. Kitchens can do that for us. They can provide a memory that is just so vivid that you feel it in your mind, but you really almost feel it in your gut, in your soul, in a way also.
Well, it was much better than the food from the mess hall. But, you know, I wasn't introduced to Japanese food when we came out of camp, because we were living in East LA and our budget was very, very limited. And it wasn't until after I was about 10 years old that they introduced me to sushi. And what a discovery that was. That fresh slice of tuna, red, almost like beef, and you bite into it and you feel the raw meat in your mouth and that vinegared rice. It was so delicious. And this is Japanese food. But because I spent my formative years, I couldn't use the chopstick. I never learned how to use chopstick until I was 10. And my parents started to take us downtown to Little Tokyo and sushi and sashimi and all the other wonderful dishes. And so I am a terrible Japanese American, unable to use. I embarrass myself in Japanese restaurants.
Oh, you still can't use chopsticks?
No, I still can't. It just flips over. Some of my Caucasian friends can use it well.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You're listening to the Audible original, Your Mama's Kitchen. Like what you're hearing? The next episode is available now, exclusively from Audible. Visit audible.com/kitchen and hit the follow button for the latest episodes each week. You can listen to new episodes on Audible 2 weeks before you can hear them anywhere else.
When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. I love to be able to cook in a kitchen and have a good meal with the people I care about all around me. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen and a big island, and we were able to all get in and do our thing together and sit down in the adjoining dining room and have a long, loud meal and then clean up afterwards and continue the conversation. I loved being able to do that, and Airbnb allowed that to happen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. Hosting your home on Airbnb is a great way to make some extra money. It's very practical as a side hustle. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. What made you decide to start acting? How did that transition happened in your life? Was that something that started when you were a student in high school, or did it happen much later?
My mother said when I was born and she heard my yowl, she had the sense that any child with that kind of strong voice has got to have a little theater in him. And sure enough, I was a show-off kitty. My parents would have guests at home. This is before the war. And so I'd come bouncing out and say, I learned Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star today. Would you like me to do it for you? And I would perform for them. And in imprisonment itself, too, every other month after dinner, the mess hall would be cleared away. The benches would be lined up. And they showed movies, old Hollywood movies, in the mess hall. And Henry and I were just transported by the movies. I really remember Charles Laughton in The Hunchback of Notre Dame. He was such a nice but poor man, and he suffered so much. My father said he walks straight. He's a regular human being. He's an actor. And I thought he must be a fantastic actor. And I also remember Snow White in color. All the other movies we saw were black and white. And Snow White in color and with all that music, hi-ho, hi-ho, the dwarf singing, that was transporting. And occasionally they showed old Japanese samurai movies, but they apparently lost the soundtrack for it, because it always came with this man who sat below the screen and to the side a bit, and he had a little lamp, and he had a script, and he did all the dialogue of all the characters, and he had a young man there to help him with all the sword fight sounds. He did the voices for all the other actors, the samurai, the shogun, the princess. One man the shogun would go, and the samurai would say, "Hey," and the princess would go, "Ma, one man doing all these voices, the princess, the shogun, the samurai, absolutely fascinating. One man." And my father said, "That's an actor." And sure enough, when we were released from camp, my father bought a portable radio while we were still living on Skid Row. And suddenly the world opened up. Green Hornet, B-Bar-B, and the Bobby Benson and the Riders of the Range. It was the movies that helped me escape the barbed wire fence vicariously. And on Skid Row, I went to New York and saw the Green Hornet roaring through Manhattan and cowboy stories of the American West.
All thanks to the radio.
Yes. And I heard Gene Autry, I think it was, who sang "Don't Fence Me In," and a popular song, like the way we thought when we were fenced in. Oh, give me land, lots of land under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in. This box called a radio was wonderful. And this is what freedom means. Music, entertainment, and movies were staged for radio, Lux Radio Theater. And I still remember the music that came on. This is William Keeley with Lux Radio Theater. Da 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 da. I mean, it was a wonderful magic box. And just sound and voice, the human voice, provided me with all that escape.
As you grew as an actor and started taking on more and more roles, you know, many of us know, love, will forever remember you as Sulu. When you auditioned for that role, did you understand that playing that particular role on that particular show would forever define your life and particularly your life as an actor?
I didn't quite think that way. But I thought it was a great, wonderful opportunity for me personally. It was a pilot film for a series, which means if it sold, it's regular employment. But also, Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, explained to me something about his philosophy for the show. He said, the 1960s is turbulent with a lot of stories that could be told. The civil rights movement with African Americans, with the eloquent voice of Dr. Martin Luther King, Vietnam War with the peace movement, as well as those that fiercely supported the war. And he wanted to be able to reflect some of that. But how to do it? Because TV is an advertising medium. And he said he found a way to do it. He was going to use metaphor and put the metaphor in the future, 300 years in the future. Astronauts soaring through space in a spaceship, round and circular, like this blue planet that we inhabit. And the strength of this blue planet is its diversity, coming together, respecting each other, in fact, taking joy and pride in each other, and finding that diversity engaging, interesting, as well as our strength. And here's this planet with these people here in North America. And he said, the North American is going to be the captain, and he didn't cast an American. He cast a Canadian as the captain. Here's Europe, and the Scots are famous for seafaring. And so the engineer was a Scotsman. And here's Africa, and that's a lot of people with a great history. And here's this vast area called Asia. But he had a problem with depicting the Asian, because Asia is many countries, many languages, many cultures, and mid-20th century Asia was turbulent with warfare, colonization, rebellion, and he didn't want to suggest taking sides, because every Asian surname is nationally specific.
Mm-hmm.
Tanaka is Japanese,
mm-hmm.
Wong is Chinese, Kim is Korean. And if he chose any of those names, he's taking sides. He wanted to find a name that suggested all of Asia, its diversity. And he had a map of Asia pinned on his office wall, and he was staring at it. And he found off the coast of the Philippines a sea called the Sulu Sea. And he thought, the waters of a sea touch all shores. That's what the Asian character will be. And all of that diversity coming together, working together in concert for a common goal, and contributing this vantage point, this expertise from that culture, and this unique, interesting point from another culture. That's what's going to give this starship this strength and boldly go where no one had gone before. And so I loved the idea, and I desperately wanted to get cast in it. And of course, I knew that this character, as part of the leadership team, I would be representing people that look like this. And I went to my agent and said, whatever it takes, get me this role. And it came to be. And Star Trek went on and on. Next Generation.
It's still going on.
And new shows, new spinoffs, still going on. 57 years. Isn't that something?
That's something. And you are much beloved. Much beloved. I'm wondering if there is any special things that your family did to celebrate the holidays. Did they celebrate Christmas? Were there any other holidays that they celebrated? Because the kitchen is often a center of activity during those special times.
Christmas is a special holiday, but the Japanese celebrate New Year's because that is the Japanese big winter holiday. And for that, the traditional thing is we visit each other's homes, and we also eat at our relatives' homes. And my mother would start cooking Japanese food this time from a week before New Year's. And on New Year's morning, the dining room table will be covered with various dishes, exotic dishes, some delicious, others a little bit more exotic and demanding.
That's a very diplomatic word.
And our uncle and his family would come and sit and eat and talk, and the kids would play.
So when you were a kid and you described some of the things were delicious and some were, as you said, exotic, what would fall in the delicious category and what was considered exotic and maybe not exactly delicious, but interesting?
I love sushi, and especially my mother's sushi, because they weren't all the restaurant kind of sushis. Some were, she would take a cube of tofu, fry it, and carve out the inside so that she would have a tofu skin shell, and stuff that with her special rice concoction, vinegared rice, but with little bits of carrots. And we would call them footballs because they look like footballs, brown. The Japanese word is inari, her inari sushi. I love that. What I considered exotically challenging was what she called gobo. It's a gray root that's cut into a string-like shape, and it's fried, and it tastes like gray root fried.
Okay. That's part of the traditional. No sauce, no seasoning, just tastes like woodsy.
Well, you dip it in soy sauce, and that's okay. The flavoring. And then gnawing.
Well, it's probably good for you. Probably has some sort of, ups your vitamin intake. Build your resistance.
It's supposed to have a lot of vitamins. Yeah. She would say it's good for you. And she cut it long because the length suggests longevity.
Okay. And that's why you had it at the beginning of the year.
Yes. And I'm 86 years old now. And because of a lot of gnawing on gray root, fried, dipped in soy sauce.
Well, I wish you love, laughter, and longevity.
Thank you very much.
I have enjoyed talking to you. Thank you for sharing your stories. Thank you so much for all that you do to lift up America and Americans, particularly those whose voices now are not always heard. And I am so tempted to say, Mr. Takei, take us out.
aye, ma'am. Live long and prosper.
Live long and prosper. Much love to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I enjoyed the conversation.
Man, I really loved this conversation. I cannot wait to try my hand at those delicious little Japanese footballs in my own kitchen. This is a story that will stay with me for a long time. I am so deeply impressed by George's warmth and his humor and his resilience in the face of everything that he's experienced. And that gobo root he mentioned, I hope it's on the menu as he celebrates every new year, because we would be lucky indeed to get a lot more years of stories and humor and wisdom from George Takei. If you want to try his family recipes in your kitchen too, check out my Instagram page at Michelle_Norris. That's 2 underscores. Thanks for joining us. Make sure and come back to hear all of our episodes. Make sure and subscribe and let us know what you think. We love hearing from you. Take good care. This has been a Higher Ground, an Audible original produced by Higher Ground Studios. Senior producer, Natalie Rin. Producer, Sonia Tan. And associate producer, Angel Carreras. Sound design and engineering from Andrew Epen and Roy Baum. Higher Ground Audio's editorial assistants are Jenna Levin and Camilla Thurtacus. Executive producers for Higher Ground are Nick White, Mukta Mohan, Dan Fearman, and me, Michelle Norris. Executive producers for Audible are Nick D'Angelo and Ann Hepperman. The show's closing song is 504 by the Soul Rebels. Editorial and web support from Melissa Baer and Say What Media. Our talent booker is Angela Peluso. And special thanks this week to Threshold Studios. Chief Content Officer for Audible is Rachel Giazza. And that's it. Goodbye, everybody.
Copyright 2023 by Higher Ground Audio, LLC. Sound recording copyright 2023 by Higher Ground Audio, LLC. Higher Ground.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.